My name is Bill Erbrock. I'm from the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh from the Department of Religious Studies. This is the fifth and final session of a series that we've been doing this week that I entitled Suffering Under the Shadow, playing on our summer theme, Under the Shadow of God's Wings. We've been discussing this week variations on that theme, and specifically have focused on four stories about women in the Old Testament scriptures that raise into our consciousness special sufferings that many women in many times and places have borne for humanity, and I've hoped to push us to dare to say, have borne for God. And the hope of all of these sessions this week has been that by memorializing these four often forgotten women, we ourselves might be newly empowered to bear our own sufferings and to become healers as together, men and women, we seek for fuller ways of imaging God in our lives and our societies. We have looked at Hagar and Tamar and an unnamed woman from Bethlehem. Today we're remembering the daughter of Jephthah, she has no more name than that, whose story is told in a portion of Judges chapter 11. And once again, I'm using a lot of insights that I have borrowed from Phyllis Trible in her book Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings in Biblical Narratives. I want to start by quoting Phyllis Trible's characterization of Jephthah's daughter on page 101. The daughter of the mighty warrior Jephthah is nameless. Her father is of illegitimate birth. Her mother is never mentioned. Her grandmother was a harlot, and her grandfather cannot be identified. So the girl emerges as an isolated figure in the traditions of Israel, as well as in this particular story. Quote, she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. Unquote. If the narrator's description singles her out for pity, nevertheless, at the same time, it evokes sympathy for Jephthah, whose own vow threatens to destroy his most precious possession. Father and daughter are held together in the ambiguity of tragedy. I want to try today, I'll do my best, and when it gets to be about 4:30, please start giving me lots of high signs. I want to try to get through the story fairly quickly because I would like to use a lot of the time today, if possible, we'll see how it goes, for response to some sorts of questions I think that have been emerging over the week. I had several people who responded yesterday after that awful story in Judges 19 about the Levite's concubine, his kept woman. The people who asked, well, why did we do this and what were we really aiming at? And I guess yesterday I really didn't have much more aim than to simply memorialize that abused woman the way Phyllis Trible does and simply put her before us. And sometimes I think it's important not to say much more than to present the story, because then the story goes its own way and does its own creative work within us. And if it does its creative work, we start seeking out the ways in which that story is still being played out around us, and one would hope that we would start discovering ways of changing the story. So sometimes I think the stories are so powerful, there's not an awfully lot that you need to add to them. In fact, it almost seems sacrilegious to say more than what's been said so well and so powerfully. But I would like to do some kind of threading together today, especially since I have the impression that at least half of you have been to several of these sessions already, and it might be good for us to do some stitching. For those of you who are here for the first time today, don't worry, because it will be also a session that'll kind of hang together on its own. Let's very briefly talk about the context of this story about Jephthah's daughter. It's a part of a larger cycle about Jephthah that begins in chapter 10, verse 6, and runs through chapter 12, verse 7. If you just want to glance through in your scriptures, you'll notice that there is an introductory section beginning in 10:6 and running through 11:3 that talks about two crises. A crisis between Israel and the Ammonites, Phyllis Trible calls it a public crisis, and a crisis between Jephthah himself and his fellow Israelites. The crisis between Israel and Ammon is an argument over territory, right? And the crisis between Jephthah and his fellow Israelites is that even though he's a mighty warrior, he's an outcast of sorts because he doesn't have a good pedigree, right? It says in chapter 11 at the beginning, he was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. We might say it a little bit differently in English. Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Gilead is simply the name of his territory. It's like all those Germans who came over to this country and ended up getting the last name Bayer or Bayer. Because when they told the immigration officers on Ellis Island, you know, when they asked who they were, they said, Byron, they're from Bavaria. So he ended up with all these Bayers over here. His father's Gilead. We don't even know who his father was, really. And it says, Gilead's wife also bore him sons, real legitimate sons. And when the legitimate wife's sons grew up, they threw out Jephthah and said to him, no way you're going to inherit in our father's house. You're the son of another woman. So he fled from his brothers and dwelt in a territory called Tov, and it says a bunch of rabble collected around Jephthah and he used to go raiding. A rather interesting and colorful background for the one who is to become Israel's savior in this book of saviors. I think it's unfortunate that we titled the book Judges, by the way, as an aside. It's nothing to do with judges the way we understand judges. What they are is heroic figures, including a couple of women, right? Like Deborah. They're heroes. It's a book of heroes and heroines, but they're all people who do something to save Israel from trouble. So if I had my druthers, I'd title this book the Book of Saviors. An unlikely background for the Savior. But then, that's not too unusual. Scriptural traditions are always full of that. Unlikely backgrounds, right? That which is surprised and unlikely is what gets chosen. So that's the background. The first scene then talks about a partial resolution and an ongoing conflict. The partial resolution is on the private crisis because finally Jephthah and some of the elders of Gilead work out a pact between them that Jephthah will be their leader to help them go against the Ammonites, and if he comes back victorious, then he'll get some status in the society. So there's a partial revolution of that inner conflict between Jephthah and his fellow Israelites. But the other conflict between Israel and the Ammonites gets exacerbated, right? There are two emissaries that are sent to the king of the Ammonites, and on each occasion, nothing is resolved. And so we are ready now for the battle and the major scene in the Jephthah cycle, and that is the story that we have today. The story of how the conflict between Israel and Ammon was resolved with an Israelite victory, but with an unexpected added private conflict that Jephthah had not counted on. A conflict now between himself and his daughter, which also gets resolved in a terrifying way. And then, in the rest of the Jephthah cycle, there is a concluding section in chapter 12, which talks about another conflict that develops among some of the tribes, because some of them were jealous that they hadn't been called on to help reap the big victory against the Ammonites, and there's a final notice of the death of Jephthah. So what we're spending our time then is in the second major theme, scene in this sort of four-part cycle of traditions about Jephthah. And of course, this is the central and most important scene, the story of the victory over the Ammonites and Jephthah's unexpected loss after his victory. So let's look a bit at the literary design of this central and most important scene too. I've written it up here for you. Of course, I've copied this all from Phyllis Tribble. She has a lovely outline of that on page 98 and 99 of the central one in there. But these are the three episodes that we've got in the story. Joining of the battle in verses 29 to 33, which includes his vow, and then the victory. Then you have what Phyllis Tribble calls the reaping of the victory, but for Jephthah, it's a rather bitter harvest that he ends up reaping, because it involves the sacrifice of his daughter. And then there's finally a very short postscript in verses 39 and 40, in which something sort of surprising develops to, in some way, redeem a horror story. Now, in that central section, again, if we keep centering the section that Tribble calls reaping the victory, that ironic reaping of victory, on page 98 and 99, she has a very neat little outline of what goes on in that central section, and you can see that it's an enveloped section. I like to call these envelopes, Phyllis Tribble prefers to talk about circles, but I like to talk about envelopes, because what you do is you put something inside like this, paper in there, and then you put yet another thing inside here. And you read the first page, you read the second page, you come to the central page, and then the fourth page reproduces the second page in some ways, and the fifth page goes back to the first page. So if you prefer it's a circular design, or if you prefer the way I talk about it, it's an envelope design, or if you prefer it's a bracketed sort of design, whatever. But you have narrated discourse on the outside in verses 34, 35 on the one hand and 38 and 39 on the other. And on the inside, you have some direct discourse, right? The father speaks, the daughter speaks, the daughter speaks, the father speaks. So you have narration, father speaks, daughter speaks, daughter speaks, father speaks, narration. In Greek, we call this a chiastic development because it reproduces the letter chi, which looks like an X in English. You move in, then you come back out, as it were. Or you go one direction, and then you come back the other direction. And it's often done within lines of poetry, too. So it's, again, we've talked about this before, how sometimes you, in this literature, you know, you're talking about horror stories, but the way the narrator tells the horror story is so beautifully artistic. In some ways, it kind of takes an edge off, but in other ways, it heightens it because it's told so carefully. It also indicates a certain sense of distancing as soon as you can do that, just as when you read the Lament Psalms of the Book of Lamentations. And there's a lot of pain in there, but already since it's been lifted to the level of art, there's a certain healing distance that's developed, at least for the one telling it. And, you know, it seems to me this sort of mirrors what so many of us have seen in so many of our sessions this week and what's come up in several of our worship sessions too, that, you know, the pain and the healing don't really seem to be separable all the time. And to wish that somehow you can have healing without any pain and perhaps is unreal. So the very artistry here is a symbol of some healing. Well, let's look at some of the leading themes and motifs. The first one that Tribble addresses, which is rather interesting because I don't recall ever reading anyone else who's addressed it quite in this way, is the vow that Jephthah makes. We can look at that, verse 29 and following. It says, "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh and passed on to Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed on to the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, to Yahweh, and said, 'If you will indeed give the Ammonites into my hand, then the comer forth that comes from the doors of my house to meet me when I return victorious from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer him up, or it up, for a burnt offering.'" Now this talk about the Spirit of Yahweh, or the Spirit of the Lord, coming upon Jephthah, that anybody who's read the book of Judges will recognize that as a signal that we have a Savior now raised up. Because this happens on several occasions. The Spirit of the Lord rushes mightily upon so-and-so, and then that person goes out and delivers the Israelites from their enemies. Tribble has some interesting remarks on this, and it's on pages 96 and 97 for those of you who have the book. She thinks that you've got a conflict between the statement that the Spirit of the Lord has rushed upon Jephthah, which is a gift, and which is already a signal that the God is going to deliver his people, on the one hand, and on the other hand, Jephthah making this vow as if he really isn't certain that he's going to get a victory. And therefore, one wonders, if the Spirit of the Lord has rushed upon him, shouldn't he know about that? And Tribble says, on page 97, "The making of the vow is an act of unfaithfulness. Jephthah desires to bind God rather than embrace the gift of the Spirit. What comes to him freely, he seeks to earn and manipulate. The meaning of his words is doubt, not faith. It is control, not courage. To such a vow, the deity makes no reply." I would add, at least for the present. Because, of course, later, it certainly appears to everybody, Jephthah and the narrator as well, that the God did make a reply. He heard the vow, he gave the victory, and when the time came for the daughter to be sacrificed, there certainly was no intervening word saying, "Oh, wait a minute, Jephthah, that was a wrong vow all along. You shouldn't have done it. I've changed my mind." I also have, I don't have a lot of problems usually with Tribble's analyses, but I have a little problem with this one, because I really wonder whether Phyllis Tribble hasn't perhaps projected into this story here something of our Protestant Christian mindset. She's really working here sort of on works and grace. And, you know, in the Old Testament, making vows was very common. And she makes a big deal out of the fact that Jephthah uses has a usage in Hebrew with a regular verb and a type of an infinitive that the grammarians call an infinitive absolute. But that, to me, just seems to be the common way of making a strong vow when he says, if you will give by giving, if you will really give. I don't really believe that, as she says, he's pushing the bargaining mode of discourse to its limit. I have some problem with that, especially since she herself acknowledges in her footnote number 26 that this is precisely the kind of vow that Israel made, for example, in Numbers 21. Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you'll really give this people into my hand, I'll utterly destroy their cities." And the God did give them into their hand, and they did destroy the city. So it's simply a way of making a vow. So I have a little problem with this one, to tell you the truth. And we may want to come back and discuss this a bit. Or you want to discuss it now? Do you have some responses to that?
Yeah, No, he didn't know his daughter.
Oh, yes.
He didn't know his daughter was going to be the first one to come
correct.
Out.
He didn't know that.
It could have been yeah. Maidservant.
Therefore, the assumption is that who made the daughter come out of the house?
Well,
yes, the God. Jephthah said the first one out, and that's the one the God wanted.
So I always wondered who were the possibilities for coming out.
Who are the possibilities?
The people that lived in the house and I just said, yeah. I wonder if he didn't like his wife.
There's been a lot of discussion about that, of course, and Tribble has dealt with that in a couple of the footnotes. Some people have suggested that maybe he had some slaves in the house. Don't know. He certainly isn't pictured as a landholder, although by this time he's made his peace with the Israelites and he's on the way towards the top of the society, so maybe. Others have said, well, you know, an animal, maybe. But the story is so ominous that, you know, if it's going to be such a big, important victory, I mean, one would imagine that he would have in his mind that God would want something important. Why? Especially in light of the fact that it is an old tradition, according to our stories anyway. I mean, we have no way of knowing if this in fact happened, but it certainly is traditional in the stories. It says that when Israel first became powerful in Canaan, this is what they used to do. The thank offering for getting victory was to slaughter all of the defeated. Why? Because the God was the real victor, and to the victor go the spoils. That's a type of sacrifice which is a thank offering. And that which is received is offered up in whole burnt offering. It strikes us as being somewhat barbaric. On the other hand, I don't think they ever offered up any more than what was offered up at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, and elsewhere.
But also he's much more specific, though, because he does say, I will offer him up for a burnt offering. He expects a him to come.
Well, it's a masculine, and that can be it, too. So, you know, there's a little ambiguity. But isn't it striking that it doesn't say her?
But it sounds specific. When I read it, I'd say, hey, this is specific. So if it's a him, he could have waited till the next person came up, but that was a him, and let his daughter be free. So, yeah. I mean, there is that little out there.
Well, it can be just translated it. Because there's no neuter in Hebrew. See, that's a problem.
There's no word.
And so you generally would say him, meaning also it.
No, this translation talks about
it's like
the
in
it says the person yeah. that whoever comes
forth. It's like in Scandinavia when you say he reigns in R-A-I-N-S in some of the Scandinavian languages. It means that it's raining. Unranked.
Bill, I've never looked at this as simply a sacrifice, because that, like you say, is Thanksgiving after the victory. Mm-hmm. I see this as raw manipulation. I mean, attempting to manipulate God.
Well, you're going along with Tribble.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I guess that's what I see in there.
I think we all tend to see that, but I'm wondering whether the story ever intended that. I really think that we've been very, very piqued for this by some of our Christian teaching. You know, we tend, and particularly Protestant Christian teaching. I mean, it's not so bad to make vows if you're Roman Catholic. It's basically Protestants who kind of pull back from that. And it's because we have a particular bent about grace, and right?
But isn't that falling back into the Canaanite, though, tradition of sacrifice your own children?
Yeah, is it falling back into a tradition? I don't know. You know, I tend to interpret the entire Old Testament differently than a lot of scholars do, who always see Israel as somehow starting out as this pure little group that was taken by the God, and then when they get into Canaan, they become
infiltrated.
Yeah, they're invaded by impurities, and they start falling into the Canaanite ways. I mean, most of the recent scholarship, especially coming out of this country, all the recent sociological scholarship and historical scholarship is suggesting that much of what ancient Israel was were Canaanite villagers who were overthrowing their aristocracy and joining up in the Israelite movement. As may be the case, for example, in Joshua 24, when you have this great covenant ceremony at Shechem, and Joshua tells the people to get rid of their old gods. You thought the Israelites would have gotten rid of them 15 times already over. And there's a suggestion that a lot of what was early Israel was really the lower classes, or the lower peasant classes and village classes in Canaan, who were throwing off their aristocracy. In which case, it's not so much that Israel is falling into something from the past, as that it takes Israel a long time to get rid of something it's been carrying all along from its past. gives you an entirely different slant on the whole thing. I think that's why it took the prophets so long to root out mother worship and the goddess worship among the Israelites. I mean, they failed spectacularly right up to the exile. And in fact, even though everybody says they were still that they finally got rid of the goddess worship during the exile, that's not completely true, because now we know of a Jewish mercenary group that lived in Elephantine in Egypt during the Persian Empire, and they had a temple there for their god Yao and his consort Anat, right? They had letters going back to the high priest in Jerusalem about when to celebrate Passover and so forth. And there's nothing in the correspondence where the high priest writes back and says, you can't celebrate Passover. How dare you have a consort there for Yahweh? This is the most heterodox kind of Judaism I've ever heard about. He just gives him advice on what the right day is for reckoning with the moon and the seasons to get the right season for Passover. That's another story. And if you're interested in that, Fortress Press right now is just coming out with Norman Gutwald's new introduction to Old Testament studies. And his introduction will have large sections in it precisely on this matter of the peasant classes and really how we're to understand the genesis, the beginnings of Israel as a people. Is it so much a people coming in and then being compromised by the Canaanites, or is it really that much of Israel is Canaanites who are converting into Yahwism, as it were, and bringing this with them and not being able to get rid of it? This will be Gutwald. I don't know the title of it yet. It's the brand new introduction. It's just coming off the presses now from Fortress, and it's already caused a sensation before it's out, because Gutwald is well known. And I've seen some of the drafts, and it's going to be a very striking work. A lot of people are going to be using it very soon.
Can you give what is this date?
When are we talking about?
Yeah.
Well, the era of the saviors is between the time of the entry into the land, which is usually put roughly around 1200 BC, and the emergence of the monarchy, which is roughly 1,000. So give or take that 200 years in there.
Much later than I thought.
So somewhere between 1200 and 1000 BC is when these stories are to have their setting. Well, let's move on to another topic. This one I'm sure we could do a lot with. There is one other thing one should point out, and that is, you recall when he made his vow, he says in verse 30, if you will really give the Ammonites into my hand, which means put them into my power. And of course, as you go on, it says in verse 32, he crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and Yahweh gave them into his hand. Therefore, it's very obvious to whom the vow was made, and it's very obvious who answered. I'd like to look at another little theme or motif before going on to what I think is the most important one. This is the one that Tribble has identified, and which a lot of other scholars have seen, and the rabbis have seen, and anybody who isn't a scholar and just reads scripture sees this one. It's right on the surface. And that is the striking parallel between what Jephthah's daughter does when she comes to meet him, and at least two other stories of victory in the Old Testament. When she comes out, she comes forth, the Hebrew verb is yatzah, to meet, the Hebrew verb is kara, with music, tupim, and dancing, maholot. Well, what she does is precisely, even down to vocabulary, what Miriam and the Israelite women are said to have done back in Exodus 15 after the victory at the waters. Precisely there, the women come out with their music and their dancing and they praise Yahweh the victorious warrior for overthrowing the Egyptian enemies. And a time after this, during the time of Saul, the reign of Saul, there's an occasion in 1 Samuel 18 where it says that Saul and David had gotten a victory over enemies, and sure enough, the same thing. The women come out to meet them, singing and dancing, and then there's that famous little lyric that everybody knows, Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s, you know, hallelujah, hurrah. Tribble finds something rather poignant in the parallel, because she says, of course, in both of those instances, it's the whole community of the women that come out to sing, dance, and to greet the victorious heroes. In this one, it is a single person, Jephthah's daughter, alone. And strikingly, she says, though she comes out with music and dancing, it is not said that she's singing. Does the narrator actually feel that, you know, a victory psalm would be inappropriate on her lips now? It's just a little bit too much to push it that far. One doesn't know, of course. Well, it has nothing to do with her. It has to do with the narrator telling the story. You know. So it's rather poignant. You know. And of course, even if you didn't have the parallels, it would be poignant because we're in the place of omniscience, right? The reader is always put in a certain spot of omniscience. We know what's been going on here. She doesn't. This is a technique that's used so well in Greek tragedy. The people who are watching what's unfolding know all sorts of things that the characters themselves don't know. And it's what purges our sense of fear and our terror, if you want to use the triple word, and our sense of pity for the human condition. And so readers are always put into this special place. We're above the characters in the story, or above the characters in the drama, as it were. Well, all right, so we've talked about the vow, and we've talked about the coming forth and singing. There's another motif, which to my mind is the most important one of all, and Tribble outlines it, and it's one that others have seen as well, and that is, of course, the parallel to the near sacrifice of Isaac by his father Abraham. And Tribble does some rather careful contrasting here. She says, well, in Abraham's place, it was a test that was initiated by the God. In the case of Jephthah, it was, in a sense, a test that Jephthah initiated. God is testing Abraham. Jephthah is testing the God. It's a test of Abraham's faithfulness, Tribble says, whereas on Jephthah's part, she interprets that as a vow of his unfaithfulness. He's not really sure that he'll get the victory. In the case of Abraham, when he talks to Isaac, Isaac says, "My father, here I am." In the case of Jephthah, after he's told her what's going on, she says, "My father, you'll have to do this to me." Rather striking. Because Isaac says it before he has any inkling of what's going on. She says it courageously after she knows what's about to happen. In the case of Abraham, he has a compassionate word to say to his son. When Isaac says, here's the wood, here's the fire, but where's the lamb for the sacrifice? Abraham says this very evasive statement. He says, God himself will do the providing. Nothing like that from Jephthah. He says, I've made the vow, it'll have to be done. Nothing else I can do, you understand, don't you, sweetheart? You know. In the case of Isaac, the God intervenes. And that's the power of that story, the story of the binding, the Akedah.
That's the Hebrew title for that story, the story of the binding. God intervenes by sending a heavenly messenger at the last minute to stay Abraham's hand and to reveal to him that there's a ram caught by its horns in a thicket nearby. You all remember that story. In this story, there's no intervention whatsoever. And Tribble underscores that by saying it in so many words. He says, and God does nothing. So that in the Abraham story, the son is saved. But in this story, the daughter is slain. Response back here.
It just occurred to me, I've read some rabbinical responses or other tales, other legends on the Isaac and Abraham story, in which Isaac is in fact slain.
Yes.
And that one of them, there's a kind of resurrection.
Yes.
Which seemingly has been repressed to prevent the Christians from getting a hold of that story, or perhaps some other reason. But one of the things that I seem to remember from looking at that story more closely is that there really is some evidence in the story that Abraham went back alone. I think it doesn't go back with him, and so that would lead you to believe that he was in fact killed.
A very strange story. Carol Nolte has been mentioning here that in rabbinic traditions, see, this is one of the most famous stories of all in rabbinic tradition. And in the section in Phyllis Tribble's chapter here, you know, she always talks about responses. How has the story been treated later on in tradition? Well, the story, she doesn't mention this here in so many words, but I would have added it as one more contrast. The story of the sacrifice of Isaac in later tradition just gets lots of press. And it's embellished and elaborated. There are variations on the theme. It's very clear that there are connections that are made to the story of Jesus in the New Testament. The church picks that up, and you have, you know, and yes, mosaics, and you can go to any number of great cathedrals in Europe, and you see the Isaac window, and then right next to it is the crucifixion window. So you make the connection between Abraham offering his son and God offering his son. You know, and all these embellishments, I mean, the rabbis even, I sort of think some of this was in response to Christian teaching. And that's why Isaac, in later rabbinic tradition, actually was killed, and then the God resurrects him. I think that's a response to Christian tradition. I don't think it comes the other way around. There's also the grief of the mothers. Just as Christian tradition makes a big thing out of the grief of Mary, particularly certain areas of Christian tradition, the rabbis explain why in the next chapter it tells you that Sarah died. Because when Abraham got back home and told her of the near death of Isaac, she had a heart attack, or whatever she had, and died. They've also explained why he didn't come home. He didn't come home because on the way back, Abraham decided to send him to an academy. You remember, Isaac was a grown boy. He's already well in his teens at this time, at this sacrifice. And therefore, some rabbinic traditions also pick up on that to really make Isaac into a Christ figure, because, of course, his father couldn't have forced him to be bound and made him wait there for the knife to descend. I mean, the lad wasn't stupid. And he could have easily overcome Papa at this point, who's around 85 or 90, whatever he is, but willingly goes to the sacrifice. So rabbinic tradition makes that thing. Now, where has this ever been developed with the story of Jephthah's daughter? You see, why isn't this just as appropriate? Why isn't the sacrifice of this daughter appropriate as a sign of, you know, the sacrifice of Christ? She certainly goes willingly enough and courageously enough. Once she hears the story, here's another one of these women who does not go into hysterics. We did not have hysterics on the part of Tamar the other day when she was raped by her brother. Instead, she speaks with this calm voice of wisdom to try and save him, as it were, from further folly. And here again, this young lady, seeing what's in front of her, you know, she just responds with this incredible piety. Well, you've made the vow. I guess you'll have to do what you said. And then she asked for a slight reprieve to go and mourn her virginity with her women friends, because, of course, she will now have no continuing name. Well, she gets surprised, doesn't she, as it were, whether she knows about it or not, because her name did continue. The women spontaneously decided to have, what, 4 days of mourning for her that they observed every year. We don't know how long that observation lasted, but at least there was a response to that. So that's a striking thing. I had, as I was reading along here, I had noted this into my own margin here. You know, where are the parallels ever drawn in the tradition here between Jephthah's daughter? And I had put in my notes, Jephthah's daughter, parallel to the Akedah, parallel to the death of Jesus. And then Tribble herself has this very striking note, note 46, and it's something I have never been aware of. She says, in his article on the Jephthah panel in the Bema of the Church of St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai, in a book, Studies in the Arts of Sinai, just published 3 years ago, Kurt Weitzman has reminded us that in this is the great Greek Orthodox monastery on Mount Sinai, and in one of their major chapels, they actually do depict this. They have a depiction of, there's an Abraham Isaac panel, there's a Jephthah and his daughter panel, and then there is the picture of Christ at the Eucharist.
Oh, I love it.
And of course the Eucharist is the living symbol of the crucifixion, right? Now, that's the only place I've ever heard of where that's been used. Now, that gives me some hope that perhaps it's been used elsewhere as well. But I certainly don't ever recall anyone ever talking about a parallel. Do any of you? Have you ever heard that?
This is my own personal experience. I've used this story in some of my own classes.
You yourself have.
And people will deny that this story is in the Bible. Yeah, they actually say, no, something happened. Wasn't there something that happened so that she was saved and she actually didn't die?
Yeah. Also, they jump to the parallel between Abraham and Isaac and save her, in their imagination.
Because also the other story in ancient literature, the parallel is the Homeric myth about Agamemnon and Clytemnestra and Iphigenia.
That's right.
You know what happened after that.
The winds come up and they get a nice sail, right?
No, I mean the revenge.
Oh, yes, all that. There are two more interesting footnotes for you who have Tribble. One is footnote 48. It's on page 114, where she says, compare the legend of the Cretan king Idomeneus, who after being saved from drowning, vowed to sacrifice to Neptune, the first person Idomeneus met on shore. Horror of horrors. Idamente, his son, was the person. Before the sacrifice was carried out, however, Neptune came to the rescue. When it's a boy, they step in. And all of you know, or at least many of us know, Mozart's marvelous opera, Idomeneo, which picks up this theme. Another interesting footnote, if you didn't see it, her footnotes are incredible. She's got such good things. 59. She says, there is at least one work that was surfaced among the Jews. It's in what we call Pseudo-Philo, the Book of Biblical Antiquities, that retells the story of Jephthah and his daughter. The point of view differs strikingly from that in the canonical literature. In this work, God criticizes Jephthah harshly for his wicked vow. His daughter, who was here given a name, Selah, she has no name in our story, so they give her a name. S-E-I-L-A. Dies willingly so that her sacrificial death wouldn't be in vain. And then God decrees that she is wiser than both her father and the wise men of the people. So there was, at least in Jewish tradition, still around the time of Jesus, there was some response to this and an attempt to kind of mitigate it in some of this continuing tradition and lifting her up with her willing sacrifice and saying the way Tribble and some of us feel about Jephthah, he should have never made that vow in the first place. That was, you know, it was an act not of faith, but of unfaith, of disbelief. And then as far as, George, what you said about people not believing, Tribble notes that in the medieval period, the 12th century and after, in our time, Jewish legend held that, in fact, Jephthah had been punished later on by being cut up into pieces. And there's another legend that said, and in fact, different legend, no, his daughter really hadn't been killed. He had put her into confinement, solitary confinement, for the rest of her life. And somehow or other that's supposed to mitigate it. Yeah. Tribble has a very wry response. She says, whether secluded or sacrificed, the female is the innocent victim of violence. Well, I guess I have a couple of questions that I would like to put to you, but maybe there's some you want to raise first, and so I think I'll keep silence. We have about 5 minutes, and I want to see what kind of responses you have further, if there are some that come to mind, either from today or during the week.
I just have a canonical question.
All right.
Because one of the problems of establishing the canon, which took place in Jamnia 80-90, which was a long process.
Yes. We're not even sure now that really was the final way it was done.
That's not my point of reference. Yeah. My point of reference is the pseudo-biblical material, all these legends, stories, that how all this got buried up, and how some of these wound up in the canon.
That's right.
I think it's the bone of contention.
Sure. The question is, how did the rabbis come to those choices?
And that the they four made? That you've been looking at, and that you've looked at. I mean, these are beyond comprehension. That a girl, there must have been a halfway house for Jephthah's daughter to, you know, scurry away for those 2 months and get lost. I mean.
Yeah, and she comes back willingly, too. She comes back willingly.
You know, so, begs the question.
And I think those who want to have, you know, some, to put in at least some mitigating word for the males, I mean, he did allow her to go. Might he have thought that she was going to take the chance to escape?
Might he have thought that God would intervene and not make him go through with it?
I'd like to at least imagine something good about Jephthah. Because, see, it seems to me that one of the most important things is what Phyllis Tribble says here, towards the very end of this chapter. She says, her story, this is on page 108, and I would say it of all the stories we've looked at, also those of you who were with us last week, her story, brief as it is, evokes the imagination, calling forth a reader's response. And it appears to me that we don't do enough of this, using the stories to evoke our imagination. And isn't that ironic among groups of people who claim that they have been empowered with the Spirit of God and that they have been given the mind of Christ, and yet are so, to my mind at least, so incredibly timid when it comes to taking stories like this and running with the enspirited imagination. Now, in Jewish tradition, that still is done to this day. And in certain parts of Christian tradition, that had been done, when people embellish the stories. And some of us look and say, yes, but then the embellishing ends up being so far away from what was there from the beginning. You know, we think the original story is lost, and then that's the excuse for doing no imagining whatsoever. Where does one find the creative middle? But it appears to me when the imagining stops, then you really never make the connection to your own life, to what's happening in your own life, and you don't get to the response that Phyllis finally wants at the end, right? She says, well, the response is, first of all, to say, but all of these stories are still happening. They're not just stories back then. These are realities. And after recognition, then has to come confession. And we are co-conspirators in these realities. And after confession must come repentance, which means a radical change of mind accompanied by a radical change in behavior. I think it's her very last footnote, which she says that. And that's a good Buddhist way too. You know, one first has to recognize that things are out of joint. When one recognizes that things are out of joint, one has to admit one's own conspiracy in what's being out of joint. Why is everything out of joint? Because of our selfish desires, the Buddha said. Once one has recognized that, one may be empowered to go the next step, which is, well, then how do we get rid of the selfish desires? That's the request for healing. And I've certainly, in my couple of weeks here at Holden, my first time here, I've heard a lot of people requesting for healing. And it's, even to get to that point, it appears to me, is a great step forward. It's well beyond denying the reality. You know. And at that point, maybe you can start learning even more. Has anyone got a great redemptive word to say for Jephthah's daughter today?
Does Eli Wiesel, or however you say his name, does he have anything to say about her and some of his lessons?
Eli Wiesel. I don't know. I haven't read enough of Wiesel. I've only read two of his books.
I've looked several times, and usually he leaves out the women, so that's another intelligent reflection. But I would think that he might write of her, if anybody would,
yeah,
today.
Well, folks, remember Hagar, remember Tamar, remember Jephthah's daughter, and remember the concubine from Bethlehem, because these are the times.
We are the people.
These are the times.
We are the people.
These are the times.
We are the people.